Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we'll talk now with the legendary choreographer Bill T. Jones about one of the ultimate questions an artist can ask, and really an ultimate question for any human being who dares to think about it. How much am I an individual in the world, and how much am I responsible to the identity groups I came from, my race, my gender, etc., or to the outer world in general? Bill T. Jones confronts the question head-on in his new book through the story of his creative relationship with the composer John Cage, a huge influence on Jones early on for the idea that his imagination as an artist could free him from the constraints of reality, including the groups and the social structures that he was born into. Eventually, Jones comes to question and reject some of Cage's ethic as he yearns to be grounded in an intellectual home. We are privileged that Bill T. Jones will share some of this internal dialogue with us. The book is called Story/Time, The Life of an Idea. It's actually a print version of three talks he gave at Princeton for their series called the Toni Morrison Lectures, and there will be a related series of dance performances coming up in New York later this fall, which we'll tell you about. But Bill T. Jones, welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be back, and that was a tremendous introduction. Now I understand the book.
Well, thank you very much. And actually, one of the things I love about the book is that you don't really take anything as a given. As soon as you seem to land on a conclusion, a philosophy, you then question it. And I love that searching spirit that you have. So should
Which is a legacy of Cage, you know. That is, in fact, what Cage was getting at by positing something like indeterminacy in composition. You don't fall into certainties, and everything can be wiped away with the toss of dice or throwing the I Ching.
And we're going to play about a minute from Cage's piece called Indeterminacy in a second. But why don't you set this up for people with perhaps the shock of awakening the first time you saw John Cage when you were a student at Binghamton University, then called SUNY Binghamton, in 1972?
Yes. As I say, that I was just fresh from upstate New York, large African-American family, migrant workers, athlete, going to the Great White Way to be on Broadway. And someone said, there's this wild guy named John Cage who's going to be performing. And I go to this performance, and it's in a common room. It's not in a theater. It's in a common room, and there's up on one end, there is a rowboat. And standing next to her is a young woman, a little embarrassed. And over on the side is John Cage with a number of his collaborators with all sorts of gadgets, tape decks, and so on and so forth, maybe a traditional instrument. And they're doing something with feedback. And I understood it later that they were sending out signals toward the boat, and these signals were returning and somehow they're being changed by the contours of the boat. So in a way, it was saying, this is, you're listening to a shape. And he did the same thing with a person. I was a little bored, but I realized I couldn't stop thinking about it for days afterwards.
Thinking what?
Well, just thinking about how curious it was that people would do this. And so this is what art can be. It's not all Romeo and Juliet. It's not always all revelations, or it's not always getting an audience to stand up and cheer. It is actually about turning the eye back on the maker.
And since most people have not heard John Cage's work, here is an example of a related work, the kind of work you're referring to. It's a different piece, about a minute of his piece Indeterminacy, as performed in 1959. This is on YouTube. Cage reads a one-minute story here while his colleague David Tudor generates electronic sounds from a different room. And part of the point for them was that Tudor wasn't able to hear or know what Cage was saying, creating a random juxtaposition between word and music.
You probably know the one about the two monks, but I'll tell it anyway. They were walking along one day when they came to a stream where a young lady was waiting, hoping that someone would help her across. Without hesitating, one of the monks picked her up and carried her across, putting her down safely on the other side. The two monks continued walking along, and after some time, the second one, unable to restrain himself, said to the first, "You know we're not allowed to touch women. Why did you carry that woman across the stream?" The first monk replied, "Put her down. I did 2 hours ago."
All right, that's not exactly Billy Joel or Whitney Houston.
I love that story, though. That's a really wonderful one.
The Zen parable is great, and it really gets you thinking at the end there. Put her down, I did 2 hours ago, meaning intellectually put her down.
But now the interesting thing is, if you were seeing that in performance, he would not give you time to process as we're doing now. You would be thrust right into the next
one. Because he goes right into the next one-minute story, right, which, of course, we didn't go on to in that clip. But at the same time, David Tudor was creating electronic sounds while not able to hear Cage. So what's important there, or what there leaves you conflicted, which I think is the heart of the book?
Well, first, there's several levels. What is it as theater, first of all? What is it as philosophy, and what is it as music? As theater, it is problematic because it's not taking you anywhere. You are constantly, in a Zen way, constantly dealt with that which is in front of you, which keeps changing. Therefore, you have to confront the self and your expectations, being entertained, being moved, all these things which were not his concerns. What does it mean as philosophy? It means that in life, as David Tudor and John Cage are working, they seem to be unrelated, but there is obviously a great and deep unity in everything that happens. And the great arbiter of this unity is the brain. So we as the public take a kind of responsibility for creating meaning. And as music, John Cage said a number of things. He said he felt that composition was the most important thing, and that it was a way by which an artist finds something new for themselves. This is a maddening idea, because the second point is, it's even a little, composition is more important even than execution, and he's famous for wrestling with artists who are doing his work, and they want to find a way to look good in it, and it was not his concern. He wanted everyone to partake of an adventure that was about making something new. And the third one, which is most challenging for me, is that he felt audition, and that means in his case as a composer, the listening, was less important than the making or even the execution. So he was not so crazy about the audience's experience. And now I find with a dance company the company is well over 30 years, and we're very proud to be still alive, and I see a lot of performance. We're struggling always to tell the public that they matter, because modern dance is confronted always with this question of how can we expand our audience? How can we not be viewed as an ivory tower that we don't care? And John Cage, if he is in some ways a spiritual father, would probably say, look, don't worry about that. But I do worry about it. And there is something in the book that I'm trying to get at. Why am I concerned about that?
How much are you trying to please yourself and do what you need to do to express something important, as opposed to please the other, please the audience?
I'm just trying to find out what is the truth? Is it really that I am, as I said to a friend of mine once, just to shock her, an artist friend, I said, oh, I'm in an esoteric branch of the entertainment industry. And you should have seen her face. What did he say? I was just messing with her. But in a way, the math is that if I'm going to survive and I'm going to provide work for my company and a middle-class life and in a world that doesn't really care about modern dance, I've got to find a way to make something that's satisfying to me, and I better find a way to make something that people actually want to experience.
Along those lines, one of the most fascinating passages of the book for me was when you describe the ending of one of your pieces in which your dancers are supposed to just freestyle, to dance as if they would, as if they were in a club or at a party, and how your young niece responded to seeing it.
Yes.
Can you tell that story and why your niece's comment, as you wrote, remains one of your favorites ever offered about your work?
Well, first of all, to get my family into the room to see what I do, I mean, I had a brother tell me once, look, Bill, look, man, it's just to me, it's noise. I don't even know what it means. Okay. And, you know, yeah, that's his feeling, and I'm disappointed. But she was there, and I had asked these dancers at the end of quite a serious piece called We Set Out Early, music by Pteris Vosk, and if you know anything about his music, it is really heart-on-the-sleeve kind of romantic modernism from Estonia, I believe that's where he comes from.
I don't know.
So I asked the dancers to, at this point, move into a tight group after all of this abstraction all evening, and I want you to dance as if you were at a club. And that was so liberating for many of them, young men and women, many of them people of color, brown people, black people. And it was amazing. And she said, Uncle Bill, you know, I usually don't get what you're doing, but that I could really feel. And I was so moved because here it was, I had made something that she was engaged in. And I realized that I was lonely. I was lonely for that kind of embrace. Now, it sounds like I'm talking about race, and I may be talking about race, but it's also about origin and home. Could I actually ever do anything that came from deep within me that actually would heal the alienation that I felt in the world? And let's face it, that was one of the things that we were taught as artists. You know, you're going to be lonely because the world is craven and mediocre, and they won't understand what you're doing.
But did you even make that moment? You said you made it. And yet my reaction when I read that was that if I was a choreographer, I might find your niece's reaction incredibly depressing. Because if you created the most meaning for her by just having dancers dance like they were at a party, why choreograph at all? Why try to create meaning? Why not just boogie in the moment and forget about all that intent?
Well, it's crafted boogieing. It was actually, because the world that I come from, and some of this comes from John Cage's generation, is anything, if you know Marcel Duchamp, his famous fountain and all, anything can be art. And it has to do with the way the artist frames it. So I was asking myself, why didn't I not frame more things over the years that were like that coming from popular culture that would actually speak to more people? What was this invisible demarcation? It said no to so much. Now, I know why, but I was asking myself, how could I be more, have more fun? How could I really think, more importantly, who is in the audience? And what tropes, what symbols do they see and hear? I don't have to be slavish about it, but I could also expand my palette.
Bill T. Jones, the choreographer with us, his new book, Story/Time, The Life of an Idea. I want to get back to Cage and identity politics, because I think part of the tension that you've experienced for a long time as you reflect in the book is that Cage came to represent the 1960s counterculture for you in a certain way that had very much to do with individualism and being disconnected from social expectations. In contrast to an identity politics frame for art, which was emerging at the same time and which I guess has become more important to you over the course of your lifetime, correct?
Yes, I suppose you would say the 60s was identity politics was very much in the air, but it came back with a vengeance in the late 80s and 90s with people, well, quite frankly, like myself, people who wanted to define themselves as black or gay or Asian or women or transgender or whatever, and their work had to be seen through the prism of that specificity. I wanted to find a way to, in this book, to talk about the dilemma, which shouldn't be a dilemma, but can it just be, can I be freer? Can I speak to the world in the way I think? And when you see 10 of my stories back to back, they might go from folkloric stories from my mother and father, something about my own spiritual background, something about sexuality, something about what it means to be commuting from the suburb into the city every day, something about thinking about art, something about looking at art. And because that is what's going on in my mind all the time. Now, good composition says, find one of those things, dig down deep into it, and deliver us a masterpiece. John Cage didn't believe in masterpieces. He believed in this sort of process of transformation, he said, transformation. And you know, that was, I say that he is a great giver of permission, and that his writings about composition and creation were at once a provocation and an encouragement and a provocation. Be free, Bill. And also, but realize that you've got to find a way to do what is necessary. Now, what the devil is necessary? Pay my bills?
And in that context, to make it even more thick, Cage claimed that feelings were a trap, as you quote him. We're always going to get to the feelings we know and avoid the ones we don't like. And that's a very challenging position.
Well, he particularly, and because, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about Cage on improvisation. He believed in chance, but he did not believe in improvisation until he did. He felt that improvising, people think they're free, but they're going to go to the same licks and mannerisms and ideas that they always go to, that they're most comfortable with. He was looking for a system that would help us get past our taste.
To set up systems of randomness that would kind of impose art upon us if we chose an interesting formula.
Yes. He says, get out of the way of your creativity. Get your taste out of the way. Get your prejudices out of the way and see all the richness and wonder that is there. And I'm poorly paraphrasing one of his spiritual teachers who actually said it in another way. But that is, in fact, what Cage was saying. And that's a wonderful thing to say, except sometimes you feel you'll get so out of the way that you no longer are there, and that it's easy for people to say, oh, that is his trip and it has nothing to do with me. So if you're a lonely genius, they give you awards for that in heaven, in modernist heaven, don't they, for being a lonely genius? Well, those of us who are in the world and we don't want to be lonely, we want to be actually comfortable and love and all that stuff and be loved, then we have another set of questions.
We are just about out of time with what feels like the first few minutes of a conversation that should take place over about 6 days. But I want to mention that the New York City premiere of the performances related to this book, Story/Time, The Life of an Idea, will be November 4th through 8th and 11th through 15th at Bill T. Jones Space Live Arts. You have 20 seconds, if you dare to use them, to tell us what a performance related to this material looks or sounds or feel like.
Well, I will say that I will not be alone on the stage in this one. I will have a collaborator, Lois Welk from the American Dance Asylum there, the wonderful actress, Kathleen Chalifant will be participating in an evening, and the great visual artist, activist, Theaster Gates will be doing the closing night with us. So every performance is different.
Come on down. November 4th at Live Arts.
Yes.
An honor. Bill T. Jones, thank you very much.
Thank you.